Hello, welcome to Civil Defense Radio, where we discuss all things civil defense. I am your host, Preston Schleinkofer. This week's show is brought to you by doTERRA Essential Oils On Guard Protective Blend product lineup. The beadlets and On Guard soft gels are a great way to fortify your immune system from this season's cold and flu threats. Just check out our website at oilsforlifetoday.com. That's oils, number four, lifetoday.com. Or go to the link at the bottom of the show notes where everything is available there. So our guest today is David Jones, also known as the NBC guy. Let me read his bio real quick. He's a 24-year veteran of the U.S. Army and trained Army chemical officer. David Jones taught nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare defense to military personnel all over the world. Being recognized as a weapon of mass destruction expert 6 months after 9/11 occurred, David was recalled to active duty. He spent the next 22 months in the Middle East, traveling to 16 different countries, conducting vulnerability assessments on U.S. threats in the area. David is a retired emergency management specialist for DHS and has worked with Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency, NASA, and U.S. Air Force Global Strike Command, where he was the only civilian on a nuclear weapons accident response team. David has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and a master's degree in security management and has numerous awards from the military and civilian organizations. His most amazing accomplishment to date was that he became a father for the first time at age 50. Dave is also on PrepperBroadcasting.com, and his show is called Prepping Up with the Joneses. Dave, that's quite an impressive bio. Man, you're awesome.
Well, thanks, Preston. I appreciate that. Yeah, well, it's just, you know, something I did. It's my life.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like you had some fun and some challenges along the way, especially after the Gulf War started. I'm a NBC guy myself. Spent 12 years doing that. My final 12 of my 22-year career, and they wanted to take us over to the sandbox after 9/11, but they couldn't because we couldn't be separated from our division, and so we didn't get taken. But they fixed that after the war was over. They passed new legislation to take anybody and anything that they wanted.
Yeah, when that was all going on, and I really thought the draft was going to start up, because when they started reaching into the retired list and calling us back, I thought, wow, this is really, really something. But you're right, they had to take the whole unit. They couldn't take just part of a unit. They had to take the whole unit. And they did change that, because this war, everybody realized that we didn't have the right number of people for what was needed to be done.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was a specialized war in many ways, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And people early on was comparing it to Vietnam, and it was nothing like Vietnam. Mm. I mean, everything was different. So there's no comparison. I hear people today talking about the attack on the embassy, comparing it to Benghazi.
And no way.
And there's no comparison. I mean, it's, first of all, we did take action. Okay, in Benghazi, 13 hours, if you saw the movie, 13 hours, we didn't do anything. Yeah. And we didn't lose an ambassador. I don't even think anybody was hurt. Was anybody hurt?
Not on the good guy's side.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And then, of course, last night, your show will air later, but last night, we took out the Iranian general and the number one Hezbollah guy. I mean, wow, what an opportunity and a precision strike. I mean, someone had to be on the ground there or close by, lasing the target. I mean,
yeah, oh, yeah,
that was fantastic.
Yeah, we've got some amazing people in uniform out there. There's no doubt about it. And who knows? It may not have been our uniform that was lazing it. Could have been somebody else. But
right,
whoever did it, they deserve a year's pay in advance. That's for sure, because that was a good strike.
Well, yeah, they saved countless lives.
Yeah.
You know, both Muslim lives and American lives. And Secretary of State Pompeo was on the news today, and he said that they had intelligence that he was going to launch a massive attack. And this was an attempt to disrupt whatever that attack was going to be.
Right.
And now, you know, they have a huge cyber capability. So we're looking for cyber attacks. We're looking for terrorist cells in this country, you know, to launch attacks against our infrastructure. I mean, there's any number of things that Iran can do in retaliation. So,
oh yeah,
we got to be ready.
Yeah. Well, you know, Brian Kilmeade, I think it was in Fox News interview with Pompeo, I think it was the morning show where Brian is part of the three people on the couch that talked to people. And Pompeo, mm-hmm. you know, was the guy that was being asked all the questions. And I think it was Kilmeade that asked him about the Iranian cells that are here that could do disruption operations for the Iranians. And Pompeo didn't disagree that they were there. And I've been right. saying this, anybody who's been listening to this show for any length of time, they will remember that I've said that in my military mind, that there are terrorist cells here that are just waiting for a go-ahead. And this, you know, we got to be prepared. You know, that's another reason why we have to have our Second Amendment rights, so we can defend our nation from terrorists.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you see a terrorist cell and they're in operation, and you know, you have the ability to engage. I mean, as former military guys, you know, would we wait to call the cops? You know, would we wait for a police response? You know, I don't think so.
No, not the not the way we've been trained. So
exactly.
You know, you're changing the subject here. Your background and mine kind of overlap a little bit as far as what we've done, not necessarily work together, but like I said, I was in NBC for 12 years, my last 12 of my career. But I was in a NBC defense heavy mechanized mm-hmm. company, because we had a heavy company. We were NBC defense for the division, and we had a reconnaissance platoon, a smoke platoon, and four decontamination platoons, as well as the headquarters and maintenance and everything else that goes along with that. So mm-hmm. That's how we operated. And then I was, when I first went to the unit, I was in the reconnaissance platoon, and then eventually became the reconnaissance platoon sergeant. And so I have a little bit of experience there. But, you know, this month, January, I retired 20 years ago. So dang. I haven't even thought NBC as far as, you know, nuclear, biological, chemical, which they even changed the name of it after I left. Oh, yeah. Now they call it CBRN,
yeah.
Chemical, Biological, Radiological, Nuclear, and E is for electromagnetic or electronic or something like that, explosives, right?
Yep, CBRNE.
Yeah, CBRNE. Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, yeah, and the reason I use NBC is that's what it was for most of my military career, and then people automatically associated with the National Broadcasting Company. and they say, what is that? I said, no, I'm not that NBC guy.
Yeah. Wrong yeah. guy.
Yeah.
I don't get the money they get.
Oh, no. And then, you know, in the arena that we have, you know, we go in, NBC is not thought of very well. So it's funny.
Yeah. Well, so you've got a special kind of shtick that you do
yes.
with your alter ego there as Dave, the
yep.
NBC guy. So
yes.
can you give us some insight into what you do and how you talk to people?
Sure.
Just to give people an upfront right now, this is going to be one of probably two or three shows with Dave, because he's a wealth of knowledge, and he has a way to get things across to people so that they understand this, a lot of times, dry and boring topic.
Oh yeah, I try, and even when I was in the military, I would make it as interesting as possible, because I found that humor helps people relax their mind, and then they get more information out of your talk. So you kind of associate what you're talking about with something funny. And I, you know, being in the Army for so long, I got a million stories. So that's kind of what I do. I just never thought in a million years I'd be teaching civilians about nuclear, biological, chemical warfare. And I kind of got into it by happenstance. I went to a prepper show and I asked the organizer, I said, "You got an NBC guy?" And he says, "Oh my God, you're an NBC guy? We got to get you before our prepper group." And 2 weeks later, I found myself giving a presentation to about 50 civilians in a fire hall, similar to what I gave when I was in the military. But there was a couple big differences. First of all, in the military, we were prepared. I mean, we had the equipment, we had the, you know, training and all that. These civilians had none of that. And, you know, when we were in those classes, we would look around and you'd say, you know, some of these guys aren't going to make it. If a nuclear bomb goes off, some of these guys aren't going to make it. And those were considered acceptable casualties. Now, I'm talking to people with friends and family, and there are no acceptable casualties. So it was quite different. And that became, I have a set of three DVDs, and that talk right there became the first DVD that I did. You can order the DVDs, WMDProtection.com. All three are $20. You know, I'm not getting rich on this. I just want the information getting out there. Yeah. So it was recorded live before real preppers. Their questions are the same questions you would have. And I always start my talk with nuclear, because it seems to be everybody's big bugaboo, you know, the thing that scares them the most. So I take it from the standpoint, and this is a very real scenario. A small nuke, tactical nuke, you know, small in nuclear terms, are like 20 kilotons or less. Okay. So a 20 kiloton bomb detonated by a terrorist group. And boy, oh boy, I hope what we're talking about right now never comes to fruition.
Yeah, me too.
Because this is in the events that are going on right now, this is so realistic, it's absolutely scary. So I set the bomb in Washington, D.C., you know, because I asked the group, if you had one nuclear bomb, where would you put it off at? And it's usually split 50-50, New York City and Washington, D.C. So I did all my calculations for Washington, D.C. And then, of course, the delivery means is a Ryder truck. And I don't know why, but 2 out of 3 terrorists prefer Ryder. And I usually get that reaction from the crowd. So it's a van. You know, the bomb itself is going to weigh around 200 pounds. It's going to be not easily man-packed, you know, unless you're like Schwarzenegger or something. So it's going to be a van or a truck. And, you know, then I go through and I talk to people, when would you set it off? And they usually say, you know, Wednesday, because Monday and Friday, there's too many people teleworking. And, you know, usually around noon. Maybe get, you know, some of the people having lunch on the mall, and you get the van as close to the Capitol or the Washington Monument as possible, and they detonate it. So I have the effects in circles around, you know, the first one being the blast,
right,
and the second one being heat, because heat actually travels twice as far as the blast. And it's, you know, hundreds of degrees heat. It's spontaneous combustion type heat. I mean, from this one attack, there'll be more casualties produced from this one attack, burn casualties, than all the burn centers in the United States could possibly handle. Wow. Yes. And this is a small bomb, okay, yeah. Detonated at ground level.
Did you say it was 20 kT?
Yes. Okay. I did my calculations for 20 kT to give the most effect. And the blast travels about a mile out. It's actually 886 meters, but we just say about a mile.
Right.
You know, because I don't know. Do you ever notice that in Alabama, everything's about a mile? You go about a mile down the road. Right? So that's 1 mile.
Okay.
And then the next circle, which is heat, you know, would be 2 miles.
Right.
So two miles out from the Capitol. I mean, how many first responders will actually be casualty?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, the people that are going to. And then when I do the EMP or radiation, okay, that is about 5 miles.
Okay.
So that's the biggest circle.
And that's an EMP from a ground burst, which is different than an aerial burst.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you flew, and I explained this in the class, if you flew that bomb up over Washington, D.C., these circles get bigger. So that 5 miles, no communication in, no communication out.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be positive chaos. I mean, any help that's coming is coming from outside that 5 miles. And they're basically going to drive until they see someone they can help and help them.
Right.
They're not going to know where to go. The response centers will be set up outside of that 5 mile radius. It's going to be chaos.
Yeah, for Virginia, you're probably talking Fairfax would be the
yes.
The outside of the 5 mile ring, and so yep. People in Fairfax, there would still be some casualties there from concussion and things like that as well, right?
Well, yeah, when that 1 mile radius of the blast, I tell people if they saw pictures of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Where it's pure devastation. That's what's in that 1 mile.
Yeah.
Now outside of that 1 mile, there'll be structural damage. There'll be glass breakage. There'll be, you know, projectiles, and there'll be damage outside mm-hmm. of that. But we're talking that 1 mile is going to be desolate destruction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why they call it ground zero.
Yeah. 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 So then I go on to fallout, and I talk about how fallout is nothing more than radioactively charged dirt. Okay, it's not nuclear isotopes. Fallout is dirt that has a radioactive charge to it, so it decays very rapidly. I go into just a little bit of the rule of sevens that we have, that every increment of sevens the radiation is cut in half. And if your listeners want to Google it, just type in the rule of sevens for fallout and it'll come up. But fallout decays very rapidly. And not only that, fallout travels in a predictable pattern. Okay, we used to do fallout prediction. And they were just that, predictions. Actual fallout would be a lot more restrictive. The predictions were wider than the actual fallout would travel, so that you'd have some safe, you know, buffer zone.
Right, right.
And then I explained to people, how many people watch the weather? And everybody raises their hand. And I said, well, then you already know the direction the fallout's going to travel, because it travels on the wind. And I tell them, because this was a small bomb, the fallout won't travel very far. The bigger the bomb, the further it travels, because it's the dirt that gets sucked up in the cloud,
right?
That gets the charge and then travels on the wind.
Mm-hmm. And that creates the downwind footprint of the contaminants.
Yes. I'm trying to think of other questions that I get in the class. You know, I explain that the big particles will fall first and the little ones will travel further. The wind patterns in the United States travel from northwest to southeast. I mean, predominantly.
Yes.
You know, sometimes we get a nor'easter. You know, everybody's heard that on the radio. Oh, you're going to nor'easter. Oh, it's time to go get the milk and eggs and, you know, sack the grocery store.
Yeah.
That's when the weather patterns are opposite. So that's just occasionally that happens, but predominantly it's that way. So I explained to people, it might be a bad day on the Delmarva Peninsula.
Yeah.
You know, they may get some fallout. And then some people ask me about targets in their area. And if I perceive them, you know, to be a target, and then I explain, you know, if anybody's seen that map with all the red marks and it, the fallout just bleeds across the United States in red. And there's one big fallacy with that map. They use every nuclear weapon, the Russians
yeah.
have. And that's a fallacy because not all the weapons will be able to be fired. Not all of them will be in place. Some will be down for maintenance, you know, and aren't they going to keep a couple?
Yeah, they got to worry about China next. So
yeah, they're going to save some. So
oh, yeah.
That big map that everybody sees, and there's 1,700 weapons, and you know, it's not going to be that way. There's going to be some areas that's going to receive more than one nuke, like Norfolk.
Yeah, military strategic locations, things like that.
Exactly, because if they take out the equipment, but also the people that operate those carriers live there,
right?
So they're going to use more than one nuke on huge targets like that.
Yeah,
Fort Hood, I think it's the largest military complex in the United States and maybe the world.
Used to be the largest in the world, but I don't know if it still is.
Yeah. So, you know, places like that, they're going to use more than one. And in other places that you might perceive to be a target, like a lot of people live close to the nuclear power plants, and they think that those would be targets. And I said, they wouldn't waste the nuke on something that could melt down all on its own.
Exactly. Once the power's gone.
Right. Now, and also with that, the fail-safe for our nuclear reactors is to shut down. But the shutdown procedure also requires electricity. So there are backup generators to help with the shutdown process. But in an EMP, they may or may not work. And then I usually get a lot of questions about EMP. And I tell people how to build a Faraday cage. And I also go over what should be put in your Faraday cage. So, you know, what would be important?
Mm-hmm.
And I explain that the Faraday cage is the equivalent to a high school science experiment. Okay. And I say to them, how much would you spend on a high school science experiment? Because it may or may not work. And there's no one that can tell you yes or no. And if they're telling you yes or no, that's not true. There's too many variables. You know, how big the bomb is, how far away the bomb is. You know, if it's a high altitude bomb burst, if it hits, there's just too many variables to say, yes, your Faraday cage will absolutely work.
Well, it's better to be prepared and at least hope that it'll work than not to have it at all. And be stuck
Absolutely.
Without any kind of electronics, like radio communication.
Yes,
a good time radio, so that you can hear any possible weather reports and news reports that may come up later on.
Yes.
Ham radio. I mean, I know my ham buddies out there. They'll be up on their ham as soon as they can get that thing reconstituted.
Oh, yeah. I tell that all the time. When I'm talking about the things that go in there, you hit on almost all of them. And I tell, how many people have ever seen these ham radio guys? Mm-hmm. And a few of them raise their hand and I say, aren't they a breed? I said, they have been telling us the world's coming to an end since the 1950s. I mean, they have extra stuff right now underneath their desk to pull out, plug in, and say, see, I told you the world was coming to an end. I mean, it is a personal point of pride to them to be the first one broadcasting after any disaster. And they will be up on the net broadcasting when everybody else will be still trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
And you'll also get the absolute no BS, what's going on, what that guy's seeing right outside his door.
Yep. They're dedicated.
Yep. And no filtering, you know, no government interpretation, no news, you know, interpretation. It's the straight stuff.
Yep.
I tell people that after the EMP, ham radio will be the new internet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's it'll be the main way of communicating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's important. You know, after an incident, something like you mentioned there as an EMP, who cares about government licenses? Just get on and use it. But you should have that stuff now and be ready just in case.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm going through the technician class right now, so I'm going to – because you want to be prepared and practice ahead of time. You don't want to try and fumble around with frequencies and stuff.
Yeah. Hey, Dave, you there? It's not Smokey and the Bandit on the CB.
Yeah. And one of the things that I tell them, you know, if I'm giving the class somewhere here in Virginia, I say that this brilliant flash of light will be so bright, you will most likely be able to see it.
Oh, during the day even, yeah.
And they're like, what? And then I tell them, if you're 20 miles away from the blast at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and you had your eyes closed, and your back was to the blast, and you put your arm over your eyes, you'd be able to see the bones in your arm. That's how bright it is. So when people go through my class like this, and I tell them that, and I tell them, now, the first thing you need to do whenever there's a nuclear, biological, or chemical attack, the first thing is change your pants. And I get that reaction. And then I say, and what I mean by that is, take your time. The zombie hordes are not going to come over the hill. You know, don't break your stuff out of the Faraday cage just yet. Wait. Take your time. Take inventory. Don't panic. And I tell them that the number one thing that will kill them is panic.
Yep. In any emergency situation, it's panic. You have to have your wits.
When I got recalled, I ran into a lieutenant colonel, and he said the first Gulf War, the guys, they were out there in the tents, and you remember the M8 alarms.
Yes.
They would go off all the time.
Yeah.
Well, they had an M8 go off, and a guy came out of his tent and jammed both of his atropine injectors into his legs, one in each thigh.
Oh no.
Yeah, and he was instantly a casualty because, you know, he fell down. You know, it causes dehydration and a bunch of other stuff, but you only use it if there's nerve agent. He panicked.
Yeah.
There was a well-trained military person that had the equipment and the training, and he panicked.
Yeah.
So don't panic. Take your time. Change your pants. The other people in your group will thank you for it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to cut this short, but we will pick it up on another episode. So
okay.
Civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training, just like Dave mentioned, to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil Defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with a guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com, where you can also find this show. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook, where I post all the time, at Civil Defense Radio, and on Twitter, where I post every once in a while, at civil_def_radio. And I wish to thank you, our guests, Dave. I really thank you for being on the show today, and our friends and listeners out there who are with us on a regular basis. We really appreciate you being with us this week. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.